All right, we're in Mark chapter 6 this morning. And we left off in our last lesson talking about the death of John the Baptist. And there are a couple other things we want to notice in connection to that. And we'll do that first. And if we have time, we'll get into the last part of this chapter with the miracle of feeding the 5,000. We were talking about last time, particularly about the character of John contrasted with that of Herod, and how Herod knew and understood that John was a just man, a righteous man, that he hadn't done anything wrong, yet on a whim from the asking of his wife through her daughter, Herod had him executed. And we say executed, he was actually murdered, because there was no justice involved in the scenario there. But Jesus used that as an example to say that they did to John whatsoever they listed, and Jesus said they would do the same to him. And so just like John was killed without a cause, so Jesus would be as well. In spite of the mockery of a trial that they put him through, which they didn't even do that for John, but there was no justice in Jesus' sentence either. And so Herod reveals himself as a man of no moral standing or moral character in how he treated John. But there are other things in this story that we learn from Herod that are important lessons we need to think about also. And I want us to take a few minutes to do that. He had no conviction over, right or wrong. And Pilate was no different when it came to the trial of Jesus and to his crucifixion. And I think it's important for us to remember that the apostles lived in that world, and they'd seen what happened to John, and they saw what happened to Jesus, and Jesus is using what happened to John to prepare them for what's going to happen to him. And as we talked about, it comes in the context of when he sent them out into the world, two by two on the limited commission, and God took care of them and protected them. But then he reminds them of what happened to John. And the point was to them that when Christ was crucified and, his resurrection and all of that, they were going to be the ones to go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. And they were going to face these same kinds of things. And so they knew, the temperature of the water when they jumped in. They knew the kind of culture and society that they lived in. Yet they taught the truth. And they stood for the truth, even when their lives were on the line and even when they were put to death. So we read in Acts 5:29 about, James being killed for preaching the truth and standing for the gospel. And he was just the first of a long line of Christians who would face those things. And we need to remember that as well. No matter what our culture is like, what society is like, our responsibility is to teach the truth and to stand for the truth. And, come what may, if we're persecuted, we'll be persecuted. If we're executed, we'll be executed. We'll be in good company if that happens to us. But the point, that Jesus was teaching was that this is the world that you're going into. And if you want it to change, the only way it can change is if you show people the truth. And they have to change from their hearts. So Herod, is the opposite of John the Baptist as far as moral character and strength of conviction and those things. But I want us to notice a couple other things about what happened here. If you look in, we're in chapter 6 of Mark, back in verse 21, it says, "When a convenient day was come, that Herod on his birthday made a supper to his lords, his captains, and chief estates of Galilee." And then it says, "When the daughter of the said Herodias came in and danced and pleased Herod and them that sat with him, the king said unto the damsel, Ask of me whatsoever thou wilt, and I will give it thee." And so before, we've already read about earlier in the passage about John telling Herod it was not lawful for him to be married to Herodias because she was his brother's wife. And Herod accepted that information or whatever. He didn't do anything about it, had John arrested. But his wife was greatly offended, and she's seeking revenge against John. And this occasion is the one she's going to use to accomplish that. So it's a birthday party, right? And usually you think of a birthday party as a time of celebration, but this became a situation of great sorrow and anguish because of what happened here. So it's at his birthday party that his wife's daughter, who is his niece, because it's his brother's daughter also, it's his niece who has become his stepdaughter because he married her mother, she comes out and dances before Herod and all of those who are gathered there with him and pleases him. And so in the middle of these, you know, partygoers, out comes his niece slash stepdaughter dancing for them. And the word for please there, the word means to lift up or to take up, and it's the idea of lifting up the emotions, exciting the emotions or the spirit. And so, again, this is, you know, this is not Shirley Temple coming out doing a cute little tap dance, you know, a little six-year-old girl dancing. This is a young woman dancing for the purpose of enticing those who watch her. So I think we understand that. That's the kind of dancing that's happening here. But this is his niece, and it's his stepdaughter who is very lewdly dancing before him and all of those who are gathered with him. Josephus says that her name was Salome. We don't know that from the Bible, but that's what he says, and most people refer to her that way. But it emphasizes two principles that the Bible talks about, the New Testament talks about consistently, that I think it's worth thinking about as we consider what happened here with John the Baptist. The first is the idea of banquetings and revelings. The Bible uses those words, and sometimes we may not know exactly, you know, what they mean or what they refer to, but this passage gives us a good example of what that is. I'm going to turn over to 1 Peter 4 and verse 3 just to read it quickly where those words are used to remind us of them and then talk a little bit about that. So Peter says, and again, he's talking to Christians and showing them that they are to be different from the world. And he says in verse 3, "For the time past of our life may suffice us to have wrought the will of the Gentiles when we walked in lasciviousness, lusts, excess of wine, revelings, banquetings, and abominable idolatries, wherein they think it strange that you run not with them to the same excess of riot, speaking evil of you." And so Peter says, as Christians, we don't do those things. Before we became Christians, we did do those things. And he says, the time that we spent doing those is sufficient. We've used enough of our life doing sinful things that we're going to give the rest of it to God. So Christians are not to be engaged in those kinds of things. And notice the things that are connected here. Lasciviousness and lust are, you know, two peas in a pod. They're basically the same idea, but lust and desire that is not being controlled or dealt with correctly. And you have excess of wine joined with the revelings and the banquetings, and then they're connected to idolatries because often idolatrous worship was basically a party, you know, revelings. So the Jews in Jesus' day, the strict Jews, did not approve of birthday celebrations because of this kind of thing that they could get out of hand. There's nothing wrong with celebrating a person's birthday, celebrating a birthday, you know, we have cake or whatever. What is wrong is when a celebration begins to involve things that go against God and against his will, things that are sinful. So when you start bringing in the alcohol and you start bringing in the overindulgence and you bring in the dancing and the lasciviousness and the lust and all of those things, that's when a celebration becomes a banquet or a reveling, a party that's, we say getting out of control, but to the world it's just really getting started. It's what the world wants. The Herods, the Jews, you know, wouldn't have those kinds of celebrations, but the Herods wanted to be like their heroes, the Roman emperors. So when a birthday came around, they tried to feast like the Roman emperors did. And so this party was meant to imitate what the Romans did with all of its revelry and so forth. In Eastern cultures, it was not, and it's still not in most places today, it was not viewed as proper for a woman to a woman of the house to be exposed to men without wearing a veil in public. We think about Esther chapter 1 and verse 11, and that was, you know, the root of the problem there. that Vashti didn't want to do that, and the king wanted her to. But anyway, a modest woman would not have allowed herself to be seen in such a way in public before a group of men in that kind of setting. But even more than that, a modest mother would not have put her daughter up to dressing the way that she did and acting the way that she did in public. And more than that, a modest father who had any moral conviction at all wouldn't allow his daughter, stepdaughter, niece, to present herself in that way before such a gathering. But the Herod family was completely empty of morality. They had no moral standing on anything. All they cared about was power and money and influence and those kinds of things. It's interesting, you know, Herodias, the girl's mother, was clearly involved in this, and the other accounts indicate to us that she was directing her daughter what to do, and especially when it came, you know, when Herod said, "I'll give you whatever you want," she just didn't say what she wanted. She went and asked her mother, because her mother was pulling the strings. And it's interesting that, you know, the phrase we hear so often is like father, like son, and you can't find that in the Bible. But this is what you do find in the Bible. In Ezekiel 16:44, he says, "Behold, everyone that useth proverbs shall use this proverb against thee, saying," and here's the proverb, "as is the mother, so is her daughter." So you don't have like father, like son in the Bible, but you do have like mother, like daughter. And that's exactly what was happening here. The mother, who had been married to one brother and left him to be married to another brother and brought her niece along and is allowing her to act in this way before her brother-in-law, who's now her husband. I mean, it's all so ridiculous and crazy and incestuous. It's horrible to think about. But that's the influence from the mother down to the daughter. So she's turned into her daughter into a professional dancer for her own designs, to work her revenge against John, because John said it's a sin for you and Herod to be married. So she had such hatred in her heart toward him that she's working out this scheme to arrange for his death. And the means that she chose to do that, and which worked perfectly, was through revelings and banquetings. So when the Bible warns us against those things, this is the reason why. Because judgment becomes impaired, because when those lustful emotions take over, people don't think correctly, they make wrong decisions, they act not out of their will, out of correct thinking and reasoning, but out of desire, and they do rash things like Herod did. "I'll give you anything to the half of the kingdom." The root of it was the lust that was enticed by his stepdaughter, who's also his niece. As perverse as that is, that's the root of it, and God warns us against that. It's something that almost seems foreign to us in so many ways, but it was a daily part of their society with idol worship and the things that went along with it, and it's become a daily part of our society. You hear it all the time on the news of people in power and their terrible family relationships, and you wonder why there's no moral backbone in our country when you see how people, you know, treat their families and how they are with their families. There's no moral standing at all. And it's just like the Herods, and we have to be on guard against that. And the second thing we have to learn from this is that the Bible warns us about the dangers of dancing, of especially this kind of lascivious and lewd dancing that entices those kinds of feelings and those kinds of emotions. The Bible says over and over again that is sinful. And I want to read some verses to remind us of it. First of all, 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 21, Paul says, "And lest when I come again, my God will humble me among you, and that I shall bewail many which have sinned already and have not repented of the uncleanness and fornication and lasciviousness which they have committed." Now, this is 2 Corinthians. We know 1 Corinthians and, you know, all the problems that they had. 2 Corinthians, they're working to correct those. But even in the midst of that, Paul says, when I visit you again, there's still this danger and this threat that there are some who are practicing sinful things, and they have to be corrected. And so he mentions those three: uncleanness, fornication, and lasciviousness. We know fornication, the root of it is lasciviousness, and the result of it is uncleanness. But all three of those are tied together. The fornication doesn't take place without the lasciviousness, without the lust. And so dancing that produces lust, like what the young woman was doing here, comes from that idea of lasciviousness. Now, Romans 13 and verse 13, let me flip over there real quick. Paul says, "Let us walk honestly as in the day, not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, not in strife and envying." And so those words, again, are words that kind of go over our heads sometimes. We know what strife and envy are. But you have the words rioting and drunkenness joined together, which is when you drink, you become riotous. You get out of hand. Then you have chambering and wantonness. And wantonness is the lust again, and chambering is the result of it. So it has to do with fornication. And then strife and envy. So you want what someone else has, that creates conflict. But those are joined together. And the chambering and the wantonness, again, starts with the being enticed with the lust, and then produces the sinful action. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 19, again, it's Paul. He says, "Who being past feeling have given themselves over unto lasciviousness to work all uncleanness with greediness." Then he says, "But ye have not so learned Christ." So those who have given themselves over to their lustful desires, which is what Herod did, he let his emotion and his lust overcome his thinking, and he gave in to that and then made this promise to his wife's daughter and followed through with it and had John the Baptist killed. And the action, of course, is terrible. The murder, you know, it's horrible. You think of murder as this huge thing that how could you ever do that? Well, the root of his murder was his lust for his niece's stepdaughter. That's what produced the murder, but it started with lust. And Paul says, when you give yourself over to that, you become past feeling, which means you shut down your conscience. And when you're only thinking, you know, with your feelings and your emotions, the reasoning is turned off and you do all kinds of things. Uncleanliness with greediness. And so not only do you do things that are unclean and immoral, but you become greedy for it. You want more and more. But he says you didn't learn that from Jesus. That's not from the gospel. That's not how Christ lived his life. And so we shouldn't do that either. And then one more passage, two verses, 2 Peter 2. First of all, verse 7, Peter says about Lot. He says, "And delivered just Lot." And that doesn't mean just Lot by himself, but it means righteous Lot. That Lot was just and righteous. "Vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked." And then verse 18 says, "For when they speak great swelling words of vanity, they allure through the lust of the flesh, through much wantonness, those that were clean escaped from them who live in error." So you have Lot, who's in the middle of Sodom and Gomorrah, surrounded by the filthy conversation, and the language there, you know, the Bible calls that dirty, unclean, filthy living. Their deeds were sinful. And Lot was surrounded by it, and it vexed his soul. He didn't approve of it. He opposed it, but he was, you know, by his own fault, he was, you know, stuck in that situation where he had moved to. But he remained just. He didn't commit those sins. But it was a filthy conversation of the wicked. And as we read there in verse 18, we see the connection to wantonness. And notice the importance of verse 18, that he says these false teachers, they speak these great swelling words of vanity. And so it's vanity because it's empty, but it sounds, you know, really good. He describes them in verse 17 as wells without water. So you have a well dug and you put a roof over it, and it's got a crank where you can let the bucket, and it looks very nice, and you think, what a great well, but there's no water in it. It may be beautiful, but it's pointless. He says that they're clouds that are carried with the tempest. And so the ground is parched, and you watch the sky, and these huge clouds build up, and you think, finally, we're going to have some relief and some rain, and the clouds just blow over. They darken the sun, and it gets shady, but no rain falls. That's the idea of these swelling words of vanity. They sound good, and they say a lot, but there's no meat in it, nothing to it, because they're not teaching the truth. They're teaching error. But instead, what they do in those words is to allure through the lust of the flesh. They say what people want to hear, things that appeal to the flesh, their fleshly desires. And then he says, through much wantonness. And again, that idea of lasciviousness and of lust, that people want this, and so if I preach what they want, then they'll listen to me and they'll follow me. And what Peter says is that even those who were clean escaped, so those who had come out of the world, who had come out of error, who had obeyed the gospel and had been made clean, if they're not careful, they can be led back into error by listening to what they want to hear rather than what the Bible actually says. And so it's the danger of lust and letting lust take over and take control. And it's exactly, again, what happened with Herod. And it's a demonstration to us of what the Bible means when it talks about those words. And so things that entice, that cause people, you know, to be led by their fleshly desires, by the lust of the flesh, are things that are dangerous. And what happened here, you know, the way that manifested was through dancing. And I think it's also worthy of considering and reminding ourselves that Herod wasn't dancing. He was just watching. So he wasn't out on the dance floor dancing with her. He was just there seeing what was what's taking place. And he was powerfully moved by that to do what he did, and ultimately to murder John the Baptist. We know what the Bible teaches about immoral or immodest apparel in 1 Timothy 2 and verse 9, that we're not to be clothed with that. And we understand that it becomes a danger to our souls for dressing in that way, but also a danger to any soul that crosses our path, whereby we may entice them to lust. And so we have to dress modestly for ourselves, but also so we're not an influence for evil in the world. And so no man in his right mind would want his wife or his daughter or his sister or his niece or his stepdaughter or whoever to be the object of another man's, you know, lustful gaze. We try to protect, you know, from that kind of thing happening. And likewise, shouldn't be lusting after other women. But, you know, at the same time, that's what happens, and that's what takes place in our world. And we have to be on guard against it. And so I think it's a sober warning against, you know, those lustful things in our world. And you know, even innocent things can become dangerous. You know, watching television is all fine and good until, you know, it becomes lustful. And it happens too often in the world that we live in today. Same thing with the internet and with, you know, just people watching or whatever. So we have to be on guard against that. But one of the key things, and one of the things that's mentioned here, is dancing. And we need to remember the influence that that act has upon us. Again, we're not talking about square dancing, you know, or tap dancing or whatever, but the kind of dancing that takes place with men and women, boys and girls, and whatever. And so we have to understand the influence of that and what it not only will have on those participating in it, but those, you know, who are just a part of it or watching it or whatever. So we have to be on guard. Prom, you know, we hear so much about prom, and it's one of the things that it really kind of shocks me living in this area where, I mean, you can't drive 5 miles from any point in this county just about without running into a Church of Christ. And not only is the prom not opposed by us, but we're the ones who support it. I mean, we raise money for it, and we make sure that it's arranged, and we get our kids involved in it and everything. And it just baffles me. I mean, I, you know, grew up 45 minutes north of here, and it was never a question. You didn't go to the prom. Their dancing was wrong, and you didn't do it. And it's just, it's always kind of a disconnect with me that The Bible makes it so clear we have to protect ourselves and our children, our families, from those kinds of things. And we sometimes seem so willingly just to throw them in, you know, to the pit there. I think if Jesus were here, you know, on the earth today, you know, I ask myself, would he go to the prom? Would he be there in that environment with everything that goes on with it, and you know what's associated with the prom? Would he be the chaperone? And if he were the chaperone, would any of the kids show up for the prom? You know, what kind of prom would it be if Jesus were the chaperone, right? If he had kids, would he send his children to the prom? I think it's just something we need to think about, what the Bible teaches concerning the dangers of these kinds of activities and the influence that they have, because it literally led to the murder of John the Baptist. The root cause of that action was somebody dancing, and he became enticed, and, you know, he sold his soul, if you will. And it doesn't always progress to that extent, we understand, but at the same time, it's a very serious thing, and the Bible warns us about it over and over and over again. So we need to be on guard against that. So when she danced, Herod said, "I'll give you anything you want, up to, you know, half of the kingdom." And that's the moment that her mother had been waiting for. And so when she came to her, she said, "I want John the Baptist's head on a charger." The King James Version says, we often say on a platter, which is what the idea of it is. And so Herod, because he made this rash promise and because he was not thinking correctly, and because he had no moral backbone, he gave her what she asked for. So he'd taken an oath, and he followed through with it, and he had John executed and cut his head off. And so his head was put on a platter and presented to the daughter, who then in turn gave it to her mother. What a sick family. You know, not only everything that's gone forth, but now they're carrying around a man's head on a plate because of her anger, because he said, "You can't be married to this man and be right with God." But that's, you know, the way it is. When you stand for the truth, you'll be opposed. And sometimes there will be irrational anger such as this. We have to do what's right anyway. The end of this story is in verse, down at the end there of chapter 6. Not the end, but the end of the story. Verse 29. It says, "When his disciples heard of it, they came and took up his corpse and laid it in a tomb." And so the disciples of John, of course, had compassion on him, and they apparently had the body but not the head, but they put the body in a tomb, and he was buried. Now notice what happens after this. Remind ourselves that Herod lived with a guilty conscience following this, because when he began to hear about Jesus and his miracles, he thought it was John the Baptist come back from the dead to avenge his murder. So Herod knew that he had done wrong and knew that John had not done wrong. But so he knew, and this is the thing that's so, you know, hard to deal with sometimes, that people in the world who are doing these kinds of things, deep in their hearts, they know that they're wrong. They know that they shouldn't be doing those things. Most of them do. But they become so committed to it, you know, that you have to dig in to your sin and then defend it, and so you go further and further into it. Herod knew that he was wrong in what he did and that he shouldn't have executed John. And instead of making it right, he lives with this guilty conscience, and so he sees himself being pursued by a vengeful ghost or whatever, that John's come back as Jesus. And so he had reason to fear. He was guilty, and eventually vengeance would come for him. God was going to bring him into judgment one day unless he made it right with him. And it's another important part of the story, too, that if we know we've done wrong, let's make it right, because we don't have to live in fear of vengeance coming. We can live with certainty that vengeance is coming. God is going to bring us into judgment one day. But if those sins are forgiven, then we don't have to worry about those anymore. But Herod wouldn't do that. Instead, he saw John, you know, everywhere. But notice verse 30. It says, "And the apostles gathered themselves together unto Jesus and told him all things, both what they had done and what they had taught. And he said unto them, Come ye yourselves apart into a desert place and rest a while. For there were many coming and going, and they had no leisure so much as to eat. And they departed into a desert place by ship privately. And I wanted to mention this passage to understand it, but also because it ties into our sermon this morning on the 23rd Psalm. Jesus had sent the 70 out, sent the apostles out in Mark's account, the 70 in the other accounts, two by two, and they had gone around to the cities round about where they were, preaching and doing miracles and so forth. They come back and they tell Jesus what they had done and what they had taught. And Jesus' response is, we need to separate ourselves from the crowd, go to a deserted place, and rest a while. And we're told that there were so many who were coming and going and constantly, you know, surrounding them that they had no leisure. It was hard to even eat a meal because there were so many people there. But Jesus emphasized that after they had done that work, they needed a rest. And it's an important part of the gospel story. It's an important part of the Bible from the creation all the way through the end, that God provides for us rest, and he wants us to partake of it and, you know, take part of the rest that he offers us. And we have a tendency sometimes to think that rest is only for the weak, right? If we're, you know, real Christians or real men or whatever, we're going to work 7 days a week, and we're Christian, we're going to work ourselves to death and whatever. And we ought to have that kind of attitude that we want to serve God. But we're human beings, and we also need rest. And God understood that, and he's put it into his plan for us. And when we don't take advantage of it, we're not doing things the way that God wants us to. We're not trusting him that his way is the right way. His disciples needed a time of rest. Jesus himself needed rest from time to time, and he would separate himself from the crowd. And so they departed into a deserted place, which is what a desert place means, not that it was desert, you know, sand and all of that, but deserted, a place where there weren't many people, so that they could rest. And they had to take a ship and go privately, but the resting was just as important as the preaching had been. And that doesn't mean we overlook opportunities to do good, but at the same time, we also have to have a time of rest to reconnect with God primarily, but also for the healing of our bodies and our minds. So that's where they go, and that's where the crowd is going to find them, and where this miracle of the feeding of 5,000 men is going to take place. So Lord willing, next time, that'll be the focus of our study. We'll talk about that miracle and what happened in that context, and some important lessons that we can learn from it. So that's where we'll start in our next lesson, there in verse number 33. So we'll pick up there next time.